there's a critical sequence in the film where a button needs to fly off someone's dress and roll along the carpet and bounce on a heating grate on the floor and rest there. We basically wrapped the whole crew. We had our lighting guys set up the lights and keep them there. Everyone went home except for me, Sebastian, and my dad. And we worked until midnight rolling this button we did 300 takes rolling this button. And I could feel, even though we were exhausted, I could feel the crew, and they were just really appreciative that, you know, they didn't have to sit there and watch, because we didn't need them there. I've been on sets where it's like, why does everyone need to be waiting for this? If you schedule things properly, people will be a lot happier.
Welcome to the 50/50 podcast, where we've made it our mission to nurture and empower the next generation of industry talent. Through this podcast, we expand the reach of the 50/50 Film Festival by giving an exclusive peek behind the curtain into the creative and business sides of the entertainment industry. We sit down with folks from all corners of the biz, garnering educational insight into process, production, and execution. This week, we talk with Freddie McDonald. His film, So Torn, will be released May 9th, 2025 into select theaters, and a nationwide release will follow. Enjoy. I would love to get into kind of introducing you. I'm going to attempt to introduce you. Luke, I'm sure you've done a better job in the past, but Freddie McDonald is with us here today on the podcast. He is a director, writer. He is an all-around fantastic sort of up-and-comer in the indie thriller space, I would say. He has a film, So Torn, that premiered exactly a year ago at South By. It was a short, and we're going to get into the process he's taken to making that short into a feature, which is very sort of applicable to our audience. He's also the youngest AFI grad in their directing program, and a student Academy Award winner, and everything. He's like very, very accomplished, and it's quite the honor to have him on the podcast. So welcome, Freddie.
You guys are too kind. It's an honor to be here. And as you both know, I'm a big fan of you too. So I'm really appreciative of you reaching out to me.
Freddie, I would love to... Because I don't even realize it was a year ago exactly. That's wild how fast time goes. First of all, congratulations, though, too, on distribution, man. I know that was a journey in itself. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling very relieved. I'm glad the film is, you know, it's going to be in theaters in the summer. So I'm just happy it's going to have a theatrical release.
Amazing.
As you both know, it's a really difficult time for independent films. So I'm just so happy that the journey has led us here, but like you said, it was a very, very long journey, and the fact that South by Southwest was a year ago is kind of mind-boggling. So I'm relieved to see the end of the journey ahead, hopefully.
Oh. How many years has this process taken to get from inception, including that proof, that short?
It took too many years. So the short film was done when I was in high school. So I was 17, I think, when I shot it. And then the feature, I was on set when I was 21, and now I'm 24. So that just kind of gives a broad picture of how long this process takes. And I've learned so much, but I think that the number one thing I've learned is really how much time feature filmmaking takes. It really is. You have to be in love with that project because it's going to consume your life for many, many years.
It's got to feel amazing, though. No, and it's going to theaters, man. I mean, is that the first one for you to go to theaters?
Well, luckily, the short film ended up getting bought by Searchlight. And so, that was a big reason why we were able to get the feature film off the ground, was because our proof of concept was put in theaters nationwide alongside Ready or Not and had a good reception there. At the time, Searchlight had this program similar to what Pixar does with their shorts. We're acquiring shorts and putting it out there theatrically to qualify it for the Oscars and then pushing it for that as a campaign. But that was an incredible experience, you know, as an 18-year-old to go to ArcLight Cinemas and be able to watch the short. A lot of times people were confused in the theater because they're like, I came to see Ready or Not. Why am I seeing the short film about a seamstress? And so I'd see people walk out and I was like, oh no.
Oh God. Oh God.
Like, please watch it. It's, you know, only 5 minutes. But then there was a lot of very warm feedback and a warm reception as well, which was a big reason why we were like, oh, this could have legs as a feature. And I just feel incredibly lucky that we can see the feature in theaters and hopefully it does well. But I guess we can only cross our fingers.
It's amazing, man.
It's so interesting. I'm curious about getting into the science of crafting a short film. And obviously you made the short when you were so young. But, you know, thinking about obviously viewing other shorts, whether it's at our festival or other festivals, what do you like to see in a short? And what do you think, you know, really makes a short act as a not only a standalone success, but something that can platform you into a larger feature space?
Yeah, I love short films, and I love your guys' festival, as you know. And it's really cool. I used to be obsessed with watching them, shorts in general, and I would watch as many Vimeo staff picks as possible. And the shorts I responded most to are the ones that are set up like a joke, where they're extremely tight. They have a very clear and compelling premise, smart setup, and a payoff that subverts expectations.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I think a great proof of concept is a short film that works as a short film first, because ultimately this is going to be the piece that you're showing to investors, and your investors likely don't know much about film and they want to be entertained and they want to come away with something where they're like, oh, this is great. Like, even if it feels complete, they get a sense of your storytelling in that you can deliver on a payoff. I think a payoff is so key in short filmmaking and also feature filmmaking. And that really helped us. And when we made our short film, we had no clue that it was going to be a feature. But because it was a contained thing that worked as a short, a lot of investors were curious about what it would look like expanded. But I think if it ended with an open ending, we wouldn't have had that that momentum on the financing side, because it wouldn't have a payoff and therefore would just be a premise.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of my feeling, but I know everyone feels differently about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's my instinct to obviously have that sort of like complete arc with that payoff. Yeah. Have you heard other advice that it should have like a more so open ending?
I've seen at AFI, I saw a lot of shorts, and some of them and some of the mentors there were kind of pushing to end your short with an open ending to hope that the investor will wonder where the story is going. And that always kind of rubbed me the wrong way, because I just feel like when I want to see a short film, I want to go on an entire journey and then imagine and then ask the question, how is this going to expand?
Right.
Do you even know where this is going as a filmmaker? Have you thought about this?
Yeah, it gives you an excuse to almost not fully figure that out within your short, which is, it's interesting, definitely.
And I think so much of the hard part of filmmaking for me is that payoff.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, you come up with an ending that is like gonna wow me. And if you can show that in a short, you can absolutely show that in a feature. And this is just my very limited opinion.
So do you feel like a short film that has, can a short film have a payoff, but also be a product that has legs enough to become a feature length film? As in, like, is this payoff kind of like a smaller payoff in the realm of the universe of the feature, or is it that same payoff that you'd get at the end of the feature film?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's very tricky. And the short to feature model is so, it really threw me for a loop. I spent years trying to turn the short into a feature because of that problem, because the short was contained, and I really had no clue it would become a feature. But I think there's so many interesting ways you can twist things. And we did, for example, with SoTorn, we did 20 drafts of a completely linear version of the short, like continuing from the ending of the short onwards. And on the 20th draft, we got the same notes that we got on the first draft. And we were like, oh my God, we have to throw this out because it's not working. This short isn't adaptable into a feature. And we completely threw it out and it was done. And I thought, wow, we shouldn't have had such a strong payoff in the short because now we can't expand this thing. But really, we then started opening up the premise and thinking about all the possible ways we can structure this movie to make it original. And I don't want to spoil, of course, the structure of the film, but it definitely takes on a new language in terms of seeing these different paths a character can go down while maintaining the structure of the original short. So I think, and I know that's super convoluted, but I think there's many ways you can expand it. But from a financing side, it just really helps to have that payoff.
Absolutely. I'm curious if you are, through this process of developing the short into a feature, are you talking with other people who are, you know, maybe have done it already? Or are you like, how sort of in touch with that sort of like indie film community are you? And are you getting advice from other people? Do you have mentors you're able to kind of ask questions to?
Yeah, first off, I would watch so many shorts, like I said, but a lot of short to features too. Like you have to look at Bottle Rocket, which is Wes Anderson's short to feature.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Cummings' work with Thunder Road is a super interesting case study. And so I watched so many of those, which were very helpful to grasp. Oh, and then watch the feature and see that's where they changed things. That's where they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Even casting can sometimes change the way you look at the feature. But the ultimate reason we decided to pursue SoTorn as a feature film was because we were incredibly lucky and the short ended up getting sent around and ended up in the hands of Joel Cohen, who's one of my biggest heroes and who inspired the short film with No Country for Old Men and that kind of premise of coming upon a drug deal gone bad. And his number one advice was turn this into a feature, use the short as a proof of concept, and go to anyone you know and ask for money. Go to your dentist, go to anyone, any friends,
mm-hmm.
Show them this product and convince them that you can make a feature, basically. So that was the number one advice I got. And if it wasn't for Joel seeing the short and telling us that, it wouldn't have happened.
There we go. Well, I'm curious about getting into the asking for money part of it, because I feel like it's such a hard thing to breach. I know that with my personal projects, I get nervous and I think that, oh wow, I don't have anybody in my life who will donate. And that's not true, right? Like you maintain relationships and maintain, you know, good connections with people for a reason. So I'm curious, you know, what that looks like and if you've learned any tips and tricks to, you know, the asking of everybody in your life for, you know, $10 if they can give it, you know?
Yeah. I think the number one thing, and I know I keep saying the number one thing, so I apologize, but for me, it was just blasting the short out.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people, I feel like when they make a short, they send it out to their inner circle, but they don't really blast it out to everyone they know. And I think I love letting the work hopefully speak for itself. But like you said, you do have to pitch what your plan is and how you're going to make this thing. But I was incredibly lucky because in the blasting out of the short, it just ended up in hands of people that you would never expect would end up playing a huge role in your life and as a producer, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And a concrete example of that was I sent the film to two twin filmmakers. Their name is Diamantis and Socrates, DZ and Sox. And I had met them at Heartland Film Festival in 2016, and they were competing in the high school short section. And I'll never forget, at the award ceremony in Heartland, they realized that it was in a bar, the organization there, and they're like, crap, you guys aren't 21 yet, so you have to sit in this back closet during the award ceremony, and if you win, you can come out with all the other filmmakers. And so I was in this back closet with these two guys who were, you know, we started talking and...
Not a good start to a story.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was in the closet. Yeah, very good. And we were in there and we were just talking about film and we became very close friends. We stayed in contact over the years, always sending each other our stuff back and forth for notes and feedback. And when I sent them the So Torn short and told them that we were turning it into a feature, they were like, they loved the project. And they said to me, you know, we think we can raise a lot of money for this through our connections here in Houston. And I was like, oh, that's great, guys. You know, they're my age and they hadn't produced a feature before, but I was like, it's cool. Yeah. Why don't you send it around and see what you can pull together. And they ended up raising the majority of our budget.
Wow.
These two guys that I was locked in a closet with,
uh-huh.
but that I met at Heartland in 2016, and they're now producers on the project. And I could not be more thankful, because they're the best, and they're creative producers too. They give notes on every single draft of my script, and they raise a lot of our money. So you just never know.
Contract on the table or in the closet, I guess, at the time, or was it strictly just a handshake deal where it was like, hey, like, sure, like, take it out, see what you can do, and we'll figure something out, or were they just like, yeah, what was that, if there was anything?
It was purely a handshake type thing. It was like, if you guys can raise money, that's meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
You can be a producer on this.
Yeah,
they great. Really quickly proved that they could raise substantial money.
And I think there's a bunch of different roles that a producer can have, right? And it seems like they're kind of all of the above in a way, right? Like you can only expect that a producer like them, who was already raising the money, would just be raising the money. But it seems like they were really involved in the actual process, you know, being filmmakers themselves as well.
Exactly. And the fact that they were my friends also just made it, you know, the perfect fit, because they knew my voice. Never did they question
mm-hmm.
my intention as a filmmaker. And I think that was a big part of it too. And we had a bunch of other producers on board as well that were incredibly helpful in contributing, but they all were united by their belief in the project from the start. And we never got creative notes in that sense. And that's a big part of this too. And the main reason Joel said to do it the independent method, through raising money independently, is to maintain that creative control, because this proof of concept is ultimately a calling card for you as well as a feature. So yeah, I think holding on to that creative control is key as well.
Can you talk a bit about, I know we spoke about it at the festival briefly, which was the difference of directing a short versus a feature. Obviously with a short, I assume, I mean, you're 17 when you're doing that So Torn short. So maybe it was super stressful, but
yeah.
the pressure is not on the same level, you know, whether that's from outside sources or just coming from yourself. I know you definitely put, you know, some pressure on yourself. You know, can you talk a little about just directing on a feature film set, and then kind of those takeaways of like, okay, for the next one, here's what I'm going to focus on as a director and like make sure I actually do for myself or for the crew.
Yeah. Feature. So the short film we shot in one day for no money on this road in the Alps. And that I remember being very stressed out for, because it was going to be my application to film school. And so I remember coming off that set that day and I was just crying because I thought it was going to be terrible. And you just never know, I guess, what the lens is really capturing versus what you as a filmmaker are going through emotionally. So that was very taxing for me. And the feature, I think, ultimately felt like a big short. It was 30 days of shooting. And it was kind of like that every single day, except I wasn't crying as much. although there was times when I was like, oh my God, I hope I'm getting what I set out to do. The pressure was definitely a lot more. But there was also a confidence going into it, because we knew, for example, one of our early days shooting was reshooting the short film. And we did it exactly the same. We went to the same road in the Alps, different actor, but same car, same sewing box. Everything was the same, except we had more money to play with and mm-hmm. a bigger crew. And it was still very stressful, but because we had done the short to feature, we knew, okay, at least this part is going to work, because we did it shot for shot. And I even, on the weekend, when we were taking a break from shooting, cut together that sequence and showed it to the entire crew. We screened it in a little with a projector for the whole crew to see. And this was within the first week of shooting. And I think that brought together the whole team, because they're like, oh, this character with her thread is actually doing something. It's not just all these inserts of thread dragging things all around and whatever.
So yeah, during the filming, the crew sometimes doesn't even understand how a thing contributes to the overall story, you know, and you as a director have to keep that in mind. So that, I feel like that was a really great decision to kind of be able to show them, you know, whatever you were able to cut together, whatever dailies you got, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's really cool. What was that? Where did that idea come from?
It came from my anxiety as a filmmaker. I was like, I have to make sure that this works. And that sequence, even though there was a confidence going into it, I was also really nervous shooting it, because I knew, you know, every shot in my mind from the short, and when it wasn't exactly like that, I got very scared. Like, for example, even the weather that day was sunny, and the short has this more kind of gloomy atmosphere. And I was like, oh my God, this is like not the same. It's not going to be, when Joel Cohen watches the feature, he's going to think it's because it's sunny, which obviously is ridiculous. And ultimately everything kind of worked out in terms of the color palette of the film, and that ended up being the right tone. But yeah, I don't know where I was going with that. It was a constant battle between like the stress of the past, but also a confidence knowing that, okay, at least conceptually, this is going to work. And proving that to the crew was really helpful, because for the rest of the shoot, when we were spending hours shooting inserts of thread, they knew it was going to build to something bigger. So people were united on that front.
It had to be such a pinch me moment, man, of, you know, reshooting, like you said, shot for shot, that original short, a no budget short that you're now there with, you know, 50 plus crew, whatever it was, and a techno crane or whatever equipment you're using and a crazy lenses and the whole thing. Like, I don't know. That's awesome to hear. I think that's an experience that not many filmmakers get to have, you know, of like getting the opportunity to, sure, like idea to idea, but like really shot for shot. Were you like present in that moment, like at all being like, whoa, this is crazy. Like, I remember when I was 17 doing this exact shot, or were you just like stressed out because it was sunny?
Both. It was very surreal and bizarre, because we had two of the actors were different. One of them was the same, and he was on the exact same position on the road, you know, kind of collapsed there. And he was like, this is so weird.
Crazy.
I think in the moment I was just wrapped up though, and like, we had printed out in our shot list stills from the short that we were literally trying to match in terms of framing. And I was like, I just had to accept that this performance from Eve was going to be different from Dagna's. And I had to just let go and, you know, just let go the perfectionist in me, because things can be different and it can still work. But the whole thing was surreal. And at least this time with the feature, I didn't have to have my mom and dad at each end of the road blocking traffic and letting traffic through in between takes, which was what we had to do with the short. This time we had a, you know, we could have the divert the traffic down a different road, and we got permits properly to do that. So anyways, that was a relief not to worry about cars running us over in between takes.
Wow. I mean, what a great metaphor for the trajectory of your career and the passing of time. The idea that it's the same actor doing the same thing on the same road, but yet it's a different performance, you know, because everybody's aged and gotten wiser and you know, it is different in all the ways. I'm curious. I hope you don't mind if I dig into that sort of anxiety as a filmmaker. Absolutely. Because I feel like it's a very relatable thing that a lot of people go through, especially when you have asked so many favors of people and everybody is there, you know, you have the set that is there for your vision, you know? So I'm curious, how do you cope with that pressure of, you know, having so many people showing up for you? And, you know, there's a lot of money riding on the short, the feature at this point and everything. And so many people have invested into it. How do you cope with that sort of thing?
Yeah, the number one way I coped with it was prep. And I think, like, for example, Sebastian Klinger, who's my cinematographer, and I spent 4 months shotlisting the film. And we didn't only spend that time shotlisting the film. We were refining it and showing that shotlist to every department and having conversations with every department prior and really creating a collective excitement around the vision. And I think that was really important for me. And also with our co-producing partner called Orizono, Timmy and Alex, they were the ones who brought this crew together. And because we were able to kind of pass our excitement and passion onto them, it became infectious. And every single crew member they brought on board was excited to shoot this unconventional thriller in Switzerland that had never really been done before. So that was really great, because when I was on set, I didn't feel like people were there for me and that this is only to you know, help me make my vision come to life. Everyone was excited about each of their departments, and it felt like we were in this together, and we really created a family. Everyone was excited to see their own department shine and were passionate about their individual visions that was supporting the collective whole. So that's what made me comfortable on set, was knowing that everyone was having fun and that they were able to inject themselves into each aspect of it. I know it's kind of convoluted, but I felt calm on set knowing that everyone was excited to be doing this, as opposed to, oh my God, these people are like working their asses off and they don't even like this film or whatever.
Absolutely. It's so important to facilitate. We talk a lot about this on the podcast, but the art of facilitating an on-set environment. And it sounds like the way that you were able to cope with that sort of pressure, which there's obviously pressure regardless of whether, you know, you have other people who are really excited, but, you know, the way that you coped with that is to be, it sounds like you are very like open and honest about your vision, and nothing seemed protected or to, you know, like you have this sort of level of thought that's above anybody else. Like, it seemed very like everybody's on the same level, which I find is a really, really important thing, especially with, you know, the sort of implied power dynamics on set.
Right.
And it starts from the top too, obviously. Like, if you're, I mean, like Wyatt said, we've spoken about on set and like those conversations that happen and how a director can facilitate that environment that is friendly and positive rather than the opposite. But I mean, I think this even goes beyond that and into prep. And like you said, having those conversations in those 4 months before production where you're with your cinematographer and also all these departments, can you talk a bit about those conversations? And like, were you very much like, this is my vision, this is what I need to happen? Or was it like, here's my vision, how can we achieve this together? Like, were you opening it up to them? Or were you very much like, because both are great ways to do it, right? Because a lot of times people are like, just tell me what you want. And like, that makes it a whole lot easier. And then I can get creative within those parameters. But because if a director is like, I think maybe this or that, I don't know, what do you think? It's like, well,
it makes it harder.
Exactly. Yeah. So where did you find yourself, if at all, on that meter?
Yeah. No, it's a really interesting question because there's definitely a range. You don't want to be so wishy-washy that you don't have a vision or so strict that no one can kind of operate within their own departments. And I think what helped us is we had a very specific script. So the vision was clear on the page and the vision was clear in our shot list. And of course, going into every meeting, I kind of pitched to them what we were trying to achieve visually and in terms of the world we were building. But I was super excited to see what people would come up with. So for example, like our production designer, Vivian Rapp, who's incredible. We had a big conversation about the world, what we wanted the world to feel like. This is a film about a character who's trapped in their past, and we're kind of externalizing that with her obsession with Red, and it really is around her in every sense of her life. But Vivian took that and just ran with it, and everything from the signage. So I don't know anything about signage, you know, how to capture a feeling of stuckness through how weathered the sign is, or through the design itself. And so we were just super lucky that our collaborators would show us stuff. And obviously we had the vision to be able to say, oh, that's a little bit too much, or it's not going far enough. But I think really allowing people to operate within their departments with a sense of freedom is great, because you can always rein it back and redirect it. But sometimes you'll get surprised, and those are typically the best moments.
What was the most unexpected choice that someone in a department made that you ended up going with?
I think for the score, I had worked with my composer, Jacob, quite a bit, and he was sending a lot of music before we even went into production. And I think that was something we had talked about, is really defining the sound of the film so that we could play his music on set and everyone would be united by it. But he was throwing out a lot of stuff, and I had a kind of a very clear direction, and I had sent him a lot of references that I thought would be the direction. But I also wanted to hear him play, and I wanted him to play with literal sewing machines and thread sounds to create the score.
Yeah, it's a good sound. Definitely.
It's a good sound. It has a nice rhythm to it. And he, I'll never forget, just because he was given the freedom to, you know, play and finding the right color, one day sent something that I never would have anticipated being the sound of the movie, but it just made me and my parents, they all came into my room to listen to it. It just made us all cry because it was so perfect. And, also hit all the things I was talking about, but that I could never communicate directly because I'm not a musician and I don't know how to do that. So that was really key for us.
What a great moment.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. I was like, because when you hear it, you know, when you're like, okay, that's it. That's the color of the movie. And so I was a mess that day.
Yeah, it's like he's telling you stuff about your movie, and there was no way that you could have communicated that to him, but he's able through his artistic language kind of be like, I understand you and I understand your vision, and
exactly.
This is that is really, really cool.
Exactly. And then he had agency to develop it as the movie progressed, even though, you know, we were a low budget movie. So people, I wish I could have paid people what they were truly worth, but because there was passion there, we were able to make it happen.
Absolutely. I also, something that I've struggled with a little bit in the past for whatever reason is at what point are you doing the score for the film? And I think it is interesting to think about actually getting some done beforehand to really influence the vibe of the film, even on set. So were you guys like playing it on set, and like what did that look like?
Yeah, we would play it on set, and I sent it to, this was another thing that I sent to the entire crew beforehand. I sent it to all the actors just so they could feel the world, because it is a very strange tonal world that the film operates in. It's kind of grounded but heightened in its design. It's a bit hard to articulate. So having the music was really key. And also going into the edit, because I edit my own work, I had so much to play with. Instead of temping stuff, and then, you know, the whole thing about temp love, you fall in love with the temp and you can never get that or achieve that. I never had that problem because I was temping the movie with Jacob's music, and then he would go in and change things accordingly. So that was really helpful for me in post as well.
Were you editing throughout when you were there? Like throughout production, were you kind of going home and, you know, getting dailies and cutting together scenes? I know you said you cut together that first sequence, but were you doing that throughout as well?
I would occasionally. If it was a sequence that I was very worried about, I would, which was typically a lot of the kind of Rube Goldberg thread action, just to make sure that I was covering myself, because it is so insert based. But because we were shooting in this small town in the Alps, I was very lucky because there was such excitement around the film, even within the townspeople, that
wow,
you're shooting in someone's house, they would let us keep lights there, for example. So if I would cut something together and realize, oh my God, you know, we don't have it, I would simply tell Sebastian, we need to go back there and grab two inserts. And on an off day, we would go over to this person's house with thread and just shoot insert after insert, because the lights were there and we could just easily reset.
Wow.
So we had a very kind of unconventional shooting, and that's why I was kind of editing throughout to see where we...
Those conversations beforehand, like in prep and like really getting every department involved and having such a community driven, you know, supportive, but that, you, like you said, that communal excitement around the vision, did that kind of give you permission to ask for those extra days or those moments like, oh, let's go back and get these inserts? Because I have had a lot of experiences where a director is getting 45 takes of something and the crew at take 15 is like, I'm going to not come back tomorrow. You know what I mean? And there's a really dark energy and this morale shift where people turn on the director. So did you feel that during this? And do you, as a director, kind of take it to yourself and say, or take it upon yourself to say, this is not bigger than us, but it's like, look, we need to get this shot. We need to get this take. What do you do in that situation?
Luckily, I didn't feel that ever. And I think a big part of it is scheduling. And we were very careful with our shot list, but also kind of our hour by hour plan. And I think a lot of times for features, directors will just give their hour, you know, give it over to the first AD and say, here, schedule this hour by hour. And we, Sebastian and I, and our co-production company, along with Govind, our first AD, sat through the entire hour by hour scheduling process, even though it was incredibly tedious and took a week. We knew every, you know, when is an actor getting flown in and out? When is crew getting wrapped? When, just because so much of being on set for 30 days is making sure everyone's getting great meals and feels supported and not overworked. But what we would also do is really schedule our shooting days so that people could get wrapped and we could keep shooting. And when I say we, I mean just Sebastian, me, and my dad. And Sebastian was also a producer on the project, and I've worked with him, you know, for so long, since I was in high school, since I was 16. So we had this collaboration established where we were united by our excitement and willing to overwork ourselves to get what we needed. But for example, there's a critical sequence in the film where a button needs to fly off someone's dress and roll along the carpet and bounce on a heating grate on the floor and rest there. And I will never forget, we were gonna start doing it, and we basically wrapped the whole crew. We had our lighting guys set up the lights and keep them there. Everyone went home except for me, Sebastian, and my dad.
Wow.
And we worked until midnight rolling this button we did 300 takes rolling this button. And I could feel, even though we were exhausted, I could feel the crew, because the crew saw us come back at, you know, to eventually get our dinner. And they were just really appreciative that, you know, they didn't have to sit there and watch rolling this button all this time, because we didn't need them there. And a lot of times I've been on sets where it's like, why does everyone need to be waiting for this?
Yes.
You could, if you schedule things properly, people will be a lot happier. So that's kind of,
it's simple though, man. It's you care, you know, and I've had a lot of these conversations because I'm always interested to hear. I have not been lucky enough to see a Greta Gerwig directing a set, or, you know, any of these kind of hot directors at the moment, like in their, you know, on set, but so many of them, or at least the big takeaways, it's so clear of just like these directors care.
Yeah.
Like you care, Freddie, you know, like you spent that week digging through a schedule hour by hour so that you can have those moments on set where the crew is not having to sit there and like, oh my God, why are we all standing here for this 300th take?
Exactly.
Sure, if you did do that, they would not be pumped about the next day or the week after that or the month after, right? So it's like, or they would not want to work with you again. But that's going to make you an incredibly successful filmmaker, as you already are, but just will continue to do that, you know? And if anything, to inspire people on set to do that with their own projects, you know? And I think that is so integral, like, for the next generation of Hollywood, is having filmmakers like you who have that true, genuine passion and like awareness of people and like seeing people as people, like Wyatt said, of like you see everyone on the same level. Yeah. That goes so far beyond anything, you know, that's like a really, the film itself will absolutely impact people, but like that too, and like the journey of creating that film and how you went about that will absolutely, that's just a legacy thing though, you know, of like who you are as a filmmaker.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, but I, like you said, I think there's so many little things you can do to keep everyone on the same page as you, and like letting people see the dailies with you. We always let anyone come in and watch the dailies, and
that is so important, because on so many sets it's so separate, you know, Luke. Yeah. Like I remember you were even telling me about an experience that you've had in the past that were, it's just like, this tent is so separate, and this tent is so, and everybody's, you know, and the producers are there and they're the big wigs, and the, you know, they, you feel their presence in a really strange way. So it's really important. Now, let me ask, when you wrote the button rolling scene, did you just think, what's the hardest thing to film, or?
Yeah, that was definitely hard. And I mean, my dad created this, because my dad and I work together. I don't think I said that on this so far. We co-write, he produces, I direct. And he created this sled for the button to roll down so that it would roll properly on the carpet. But, you know, it took.
Oh, but my
you
God.
You got it.
You got the shot. Exactly. And it's so important, because I do think that if you kept the crew around, they would not be happy with even however cool your dad's slide that he is, you know,
old fast.
They're not, the 20 people aren't like, wow, this is so amazing. Like, I want to watch that button roll again.
This is why I joined film. This is what it's all about.
Yeah, this is what I'm working myself up to.
Exactly. Freddie, how does your mom feel? Does she feel left out?
No, my mom is also an artist.
Okay.
So she's been ever since back in the day when I was doing my stop motion animation. She would sit in there with me for hours and help click frames as I was manipulating the puppet, or she would help me design these foam core puppets as well that I would animate. So she was key to SoTorn as well in terms of, at one point she was helping our costume designer out. She was always on set, helping our production designer. We had a small team. So, it was every help, everything, any help we could get was great, but she's also, the only reason I think I have an eye is because of her. So it was really a family effort in every sense.
That's incredible and such a privilege that you're able to work with your parents that way and have that sort of relationship. I mean, it's incredible. Like I'm curious, at what point, you know, were you able to see your parents as sort of collaborators and equals? Because obviously you grow up and you look up to your parents.
Right.
Physically and, you know, metaphorically, and like, and then, you know, you are all grown up and you're seeing them as full people and people who can, you know, have a shared vision with you.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question and one that I'm still trying to figure out. And I don't know how it works, but it does.
Yeah.
People are like, I could never work with my dad, for example. I just can't imagine it. But I think it's because he taught me stop motion so early on in my life. I was 9 years old and he was the one who taught me the advice that I said I stole at the beginning of this podcast, which is, if you're going to make a short film, make one with a beginning, middle, and an end, and an ending that subverts expectations. And because that was instilled in me so early on, instead of animating a little ball rolling around and bouncing, which is what I wanted to do, he helped me create stories that did that. And I think it's because we started co-writing so early that it's just always been a part of our relationship. And even till this day, in writing our new project, we never get in disagreements about story because we have the same taste. And the only disagreements come in the editing room when I'm in my room all day cutting, and then he comes in as the fresh eyes and gives me notes, and that's when we get an argument.
Oh my God. Well, that's so hard, right? You've spent so many hours on something. He's like, I don't really like it. And you're like,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, it's always hard to hear the fresh eyes because a lot of the times you realize that they're probably right.
Yep. That is that situation. Definitely. Well, I'm curious, you know, if we can pivot kind of, because you said you're writing this new project with your dad, and where do you kind of see yourself going in the next few years? Obviously, you know, we're wishing you a really successful release with SoTorn coming up. And, you know, where do you ideally see yourself?
Hopefully Brazil is the place to be. My mom, half Swiss and half Brazilian. And so it just kind of makes sense in our minds to go to Brazil next to shoot this next film. Literally, in terms of the literal location of where we want to shoot. And I think a lot of that comes down to, I love shooting in places that feel like they've never been shot before. So with SoTorn, it was really exciting for me to go to this town in the Alps that, you know, had never seen production of any kind. And this place in Brazil where her parents live part-time, it's a small fisherman village. And I just think it would be so exciting to shoot something there. So that's what we're writing now. But we're also very excited to get SoTorn out in the world. And I'm super curious to learn about what that part of the process is like. I mean, even now I'm gearing up to the release in terms of press and how to design a campaign around the film is really exciting. And I'm learning a lot. So it's quite the journey as feature filmmaking process.
How has the initial feedback been with the trailer and everything?
It's been good. It's definitely a wacky film, and I'm really happy with how all that came out, because that was a whole side of things I didn't even know about, like making the trailer, working with a trailer house, a poster house.
Yeah,
doing that. But it was great. I'm super happy with what everyone came up with, and now it's out there. So hopefully, we can only hope that it gets traction, and we're going to continue to do anything we can with our marketing campaign and my planned guerrilla marketing campaign, which I can tell you guys about later.
Right. Well, I was curious, like, how, because you're speaking so intelligently about the trailer making and the marketing and everything. And I know that typically directors don't have that much, you know, have their fingers into every part of it once it's shot and cut and locked and everything. So like, what makes you want to get in, because this is also a business podcast, you know, what makes you want to be involved in the marketing and, you know, share that duty with the other producers and yeah, you know, investors and things?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I just love every part of the process, for better or worse. But I do think with So Torn specifically, we have an interesting opportunity, and I don't know how interesting this is, so cut me off if it's not. Because the short film, again, this is tying back to the proof of concept and why, how important it is to have a strong one, the short film ended up getting ripped on TikTok and YouTube Shorts, all these platforms under a completely different name, and amassed over 20 million views.
Whoa.
And hundreds of comments, hundreds of thousands of likes of people saying, what is this movie? Does anyone know the name of this movie? What is this movie called? And no one knew the name of the movie. So I was like, oh my God, you know, this went completely viral and no one knows what this movie is. So I think my big plan is to try to recapture some of that energy, hopefully with the feature, because we shot that same sequence as the short, and giving these channels the opportunity to show the new version of it is my hope. Who knows if it's going to work? I have no clue, but I'll let you guys know next time we do one of these.
So is your sort of guerrilla marketing campaign, like the sort of the TikTok, YouTube Shorts going viral sort of thing? Because I know that's like, I mean, the biggest studios that are having conversations about that, you know, like that's the priority these days. So, I mean, is that top of mind for you going into the sort of press for this?
I'm embarrassed to say it is.
Don't be. I mean, it's how it is, you know,
that's everyone's goal. And the only reason I'm even saying it out loud is because the short film did. So I'm hopeful that we can capture that energy again. Thankfully, our partners at Vertigo Releasing and Sunrise Films have great methods to get it out there in terms of PR and press that I'm just hoping to contribute to their vision for the marketing of it. But I just think it's cool that a short film that you make so long ago can still give you ideas for how to market the feature. And that's part of the reason of blasting it out. You never know who's going to take it, rip it, put different music over it, put captions all over the thing. I mean, it got completely destroyed in the best way, the short. But you have to be open to that, because at least people are watching your work and are responding to it. So
it's part of being a modern day filmmaker. You know, like once you put something out there, it is out there for everyone. And no matter what the copyright situation or whatever, like people are going to duet it with another thing, and they're gonna compile it with Euphoria probably, and it's always Euphoria for some reason, but they're gonna rip it apart, as you said.
Yeah, and then it's great, because then it's at least getting watched. I mean, it's like, you know, it's getting seen.
Yeah, totally. So,
with music or not, who knows? Yeah.
Do you read comments?
It's a problem. I'm stopping now. I deleted Letterboxd because there was some really mean ones. I'm always fine with, I actually think critiques of the work is really helpful, and actually is ultimately what inspired the feature. I read a Letterboxd review that was like, oh, that's kind of distilled the theme of the film, and that kind of got our gears turning. But the ones that are kind of specific about me and
about you specifically, I hear Freddie is just the worst. Yeah, it's not even about the
movie
film.
Was great, but Freddie, yeah. Oh my God.
There have been some of those, and those are the ones where I'm like, oh, well, I didn't really need to see that one. So I deleted Letterboxd, which was a big moment for me, because I love that app, but
yeah,
healthier.
Do you remember the review that cut through as that specific angle that you were like, huh, like this should be a feature? Like, what do you remember what that review said?
Yeah, I remember more vaguely that it was something about this short film is about the balance between involvement and choice. And I think that it was literally the word choice that I read it out loud to my dad. And I was like, oh, choice. Like, what if we saw the different choices that she could have made on this, you know, this crime scene, this drug deal gone bad. And it also connected to the AFI prompt, application prompt that inspired the short film in the first place, which is it has to be a story about a change of heart. Mm. So you're like, oh, it's a film about a change of heart and a choice that she made. And she really only has a few choices that she could make. She could call the police, she could drive away, or commit the perfect crime. And then once we realized that, we were like, oh, it would be really cool to see what happens when she goes down each of these roads and how she ends up as a result, what the repercussions of those choices are. So that's what inspired it. I don't remember the exact review though. I'm gonna have to redownload Letterboxd to find it.
Well, that'll do it. That sounds really interesting. And I think for people to better understand that, they'll probably have to go see So Torn.
Yeah, let's go.
Definitely. Well, your success is so, so exciting. I feel like there's so much to learn from this interview, whether it's, you know, how to involve crew on set, finding inspiration in different ways. One of my favorite things that you've talked about has been your testament to like these long-term relationships, the twins that you met when you were however old, and you've kept those connections, your parents, which are the longest term connections. Yeah. And then even like your DP, I know you've known for so many years. So it's really a testament to establishing that sort of, that unit and keeping those people around, I think is so, so vital and something that I work on doing in my own life. And, you know, Luke and I have known each other since kindergarten, and like, this is how it is, you know, these are the people you keep around.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's so important, and you guys are the best. I didn't know that you knew each other since kindergarten. That's like,
isn't that crazy?
No, you're the best, Freddie.
I'm honored that you even are interested in talking to me. It means a lot. And to be a part of the festival, which was an incredible experience to have spoken there and seen the quality of work you guys bring to it's really inspiring. And I'm honored to have met you both and to hopefully be a part of your family that you've created at 50/50.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. We'll see you in May, and let's figure something out for your film coming out. We'll get some tickets to the 50/50 folks, the link. We'll That's send amazing. It out, man.
I would love that. I would love that. And you guys, you know, tickets on me for you guys. I owe you guys a lot, so I'm excited for you to see it.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks so much for hopping on, and we'll chat soon. Definitely.
Did you learn something? I'm like your mom. Did you learn something in this episode? I hope so. Or not. That's okay. Thanks for hanging. Make sure you follow us at the 50/50 Fest on Instagram. And I think we have a TikTok. I don't know. Go check it out. Okay, bye.